A new synagogue.
Get closer, please. I'll wait another moment. Right. Okay. We're standing here in front of our new synagogue, the synagogue of the Jewish community of the city of Dresden. The new building was completed in the years 2000 and 2001 and was finally opened on November the 9th on the 63rd anniversary of the pogroms of 1938. This place here is today the center of renewed flowering of Jewish life in the city. The building is divided into the synagogue at the back and the community center at the front. The 34 layers of brickwork of the windowless cube spiral upwards until they reach the exact position facing east. The community house on the opposite side is the counterpart to the closed cube. While the synagogue is designed as a place of contemplation and meditation, the open glass facade of the community house is meant to be an interface with the general public. The two buildings enclose a courtyard. This steel line here traces the outlines of the former synagogue on the ground. The old synagogue was built by architect Gottfried Semper and until November 1938 was located at almost exactly the same place. It was attacked and set on fire by the National Socialists in the early hours of November 10th in 1938. On the following day, many members of the Jewish community were publicly humiliated by the Gestapo in front of a great crowd of Dresden citizens. Over the next few days, many of them were deported to concentration camps. The whole community council was sent to Buchenwald, for example. That was a day of horror for the Jews of Dresden, and one which marked the beginning of the end for all the Jews in Germany. The burnt-down synagogue was demolished in mid-November 1938. The Jewish community was forced to bear the costs. On the 13th February in 1945, the old buildings of the community were destroyed by air raids. But the Star of David above the entrance of the new synagogue is one of the two stars of the old synagogue. Dresden fireman Alfred Neugebauer saved the star and returned it to the Jewish community after the war. That was a great stroke of luck.
Not much is said when someone who has never been beaten makes the ethical and pathetic statement that upon the first blow the prisoner loses his human dignity. I must confess that I don't know exactly what that is, human dignity. One person thinks he loses it when he finds himself in circumstances that make it impossible for him to take a daily bath. Another believes he loses it when he must speak to an official in something other than his native language. In one instance, human dignity is bound to a certain physical convenience, in the other to the right of free speech, in still another perhaps to the availability of erotic partners of the same sex. I don't know if the person who is beaten by the police loses human dignity. Yet, I'm certain that with the first blow that descends on him, he loses something we will perhaps temporarily call trust in the world. Whoever has succumbed to torture can no longer feel at home in the world. The shame of destruction cannot be erased. Trust in the world, which already collapsed in part at the first blow, but in the end, under torture, fully, will not be regained. That one's fellow man was experienced as the anti-man remains in the tortured person as accumulated horror. It blocks the view into a world in which the principle of hope rules. One who was martyred is a defenseless prisoner of fear. It is fear that henceforth reigns over him. Fear, and also what is called resentments. They remain, and have scarcely a chance to concentrate into a seething, purifying thirst for revenge. Jean Améry, at the mind's limits. Contemplations by a Survivor on Auschwitz and its Realities.
It was attacked and set on fire by the National Socialists in the early hours of November 10th in 1938. On the following day, many members of the Jewish community were publicly humiliated.
The good Germans and the bad Nazis. The National Socialists are so easily to label. The Nazis set the synagogue on fire. Only, it is not about the complete breakdown of civilized behavior. In a speech of that kind, maybe as much as in the way people stood by and watched the Nazis setting the synagogue on fire, it seems appropriate to quote Adorno at this point. Anti-Semitism is a deeply imprinted scheme, a ritual of civilization. The pogroms are the true ritual murders. They demonstrate the importance of sense, significance, and ultimately of truth, which might hold them within bounds. The idle occupation of killing confirms the stubbornness of life to which one has to conform and to resign oneself.
The expectation of help, the certainty of help, is indeed one of the fundamental experiences of human beings. Just a moment, the mother says to her child, who's moaning from pain. A hot water bottle, a cup of tea is coming right away. We won't let you suffer so. I prescribe you medicine, the doctor shows. It will help you. Even on the battlefield, the Red Cross ambulances find their way to the wounded man. In almost all situations in life where there is a bodily injury, there is also the expectation of help. The former is compensated by the latter. But the first blow from a policeman's fist, against which there can be no defense and which no helping hand will ward off, a part of our life ends and it can never again be revived.
So that this underlying expectation of people with regard to civilization itself founders anti-Semitism's ritual murder. For example, Leo Yehuda Schornstein, thrashed, beaten, both because of and in the midst of an extremely middle-class Dresden public on the morning of the pogroms. On the 9th of November, 1938, in the Jewish community office, in the synagogue.
They threw a prayer shawl over my head and placed two silver Torah crowns in my hand, shoved me to the window facing the street, and struck me, rocking me back and forth, while the crowd of people burst out into frenetically howling jeers. I had to repeat this procedure, standing on a chair, while the mob on the street jeered even more. After this public entertainment, I was allowed to sit down. It was now almost noon. A police truck came at 1 o'clock, and the SS and Gestapo men collected the community's files and registers, as well as the religious objects, and took them away. At 2 o'clock, the prison car came, and we were taken away.
We are standing here in front of our new synagogue.
And today, the synagogue is our synagogue again. The Nazis, and our synagogue. Every year on the 13th of February, the anniversary of the bombing in 1945, thousands of neo-Nazis take part in demonstration marches through the city. And while people ignored these embarrassing funeral marches for years, we now have the synagogue and the community center as the perfect place to demonstrate a commitment against Nazis. Civil society. A stage set for Dresden society to show its face, to demonstrate for peace, for tolerance or courage. One could almost think that over the past few years, the new synagogue has generated a new added value. The need to disassociate oneself from right-wing extremism means looking for the location of the Jewish life in the city, Its newly arisen architecture a symbol of the new blossoming of Jewish life in the city. This new utility, which is in the end nothing new, and for which Solomon Cohn coined the cynical term of functional Jews in 1999, is, when all is said, based on the desire to present Dresden as being a united and democratic collective. Solomon Cohn, a member of the committee of the Central Council of Jews in Germany, this picture forgets much. Few supported the construction of the synagogue. Murmurs of disapproval could be heard from white sections of the population. Some even asked why, if the Jews wanted their synagogue, they didn't pay for it themselves. What does it mean when it is said that today the community once again numbers more than 700, thanks to immigration by East European Jews, instead of just 41 members immediately after 1945? The city's Jewish culture can only be described by the word again. The presence of East European Jews as evidence for an again, as being a touchstone for the democratic qualities of a post-fascist society? Far away from considerations of political utility, actual Jewish life in the city blends way into the background. The actual perpetrators remain unnamed, lost in the mists of the blanket confessions of guilt so popular today. A Jewish community numbering 700 members does not lead to absolution. The impossibility of forgiveness and the impossibility of asking for forgiveness in this case both need thinking about.
There was much talk about the collective guilt of the Germans. It would be an outright distortion of the truth if I did not confess here, without any concealment, that this was fine with me. It seemed to me as if I had experienced the atrocities as collective ones. Collective guilt. That is naturally sheer nonsense if it implies that a community of Germans possessed a common consciousness, a common will, a common initiative to act and therein became culpable. But it is a useful hypothesis if nothing else is meant by it than the objectively manifested sum of individual guilty conduct. Then there grows out of the guilt of individual Germans guilt of deed, guilt of omission, guilt of utterance, guilt of silence, the total guilt of a people. Before the concept of collective guilt can be applied, it must be freed of myth and mystification. Then it will lose its dark, ominous tone and be useful in the only way that it can, as a vague statistical statement.